On To The Point, we try to make sense of the policy debates and the political sideshows on the campaign trail.
Ted Cruz wrapping the bacon around the semi-automatic weapon to cook it.
I understand that trade is not a sexy issue.
Nobody knows where the Republican Party is going to land. I mean, it's kind of like a country road. No one knows where it will end.
In many ways, Marco Rubio is the Michael Jordan of American politics.
I'm Warren Olney. To The Point has you covered for the 2016 campaign. Find the To The Point podcast on KCRW's iTunes page.
Calm, serene, and no psychosis. We don't want to scare our people, but we have already said that Mali will have to get used to situations like this. We must all remain humble. No one, nowhere is safe, given the danger of terrorism.
Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, president of Mali, speaking today through a translator. This morning, gunmen stormed a Radisson Blue Hotel in Mali's capital, took hostages, and killed more than 20 people. All the hostages have been cleared now. Some attackers may still be inside the hotel. An Islamist extremist group called Al-Mor Abitoun claimed responsibility, according to Al Jazeera. That has not been confirmed. We're going to talk now about how this Islamic extremism that's happening not only in Mali but in France is playing out here in the United States in terms of politics. It happens to be right now the loudest conversation in politics, with Donald Trump calling for a national Muslim registry, Ben Carson using an analogy of rabid dogs when talking about Syrian refugees. Hillary Clinton gave a major campaign speech yesterday on terrorism as well. So how are Muslim Americans reacting to all of this, and will it have a significant impact on the 2016 election? Here to discuss this now is Janann Reed, professor of sociology and global health at Duke University, where she's also an assistant director of the Islamic Studies Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start by hearing some of these comments we mentioned. Here is Donald Trump this week dodging a reporter's question about the Muslim registry he's calling for.
Mr. Trump, why would Muslim databases not be the same thing as requiring Jews to register in Nazi Germany? What would be the difference? Is there a difference between the two? Is there a difference?
Who are you with?
I'm with NBC News. Is there a difference between requiring Muslims to register and Jews?
You tell me.
Nazi Germany?
You tell me.
Do you believe?
Why don't you tell me?
Do you believe there is?
You tell me.
Should Muslims be, fearful?
All right, so Donald Trump seems to be playing politics with this idea of a registry, but are Muslims taking him seriously?
Well, let me just say, I hesitate to comment on anything that comes out of Donald Trump's mouth or where it comes from. I think, the Muslim vote, and there is a Muslim vote, of course, takes these issues seriously. They focus on what are the policies of the individuals who are willing to lead this country. And I think coming out with a possible Muslim registry and the closing down of mosques is of concern.
Yeah, and also you have Ben Carson saying a Muslim shouldn't be elected president, and here he is also making this analogy, talking about Syrian refugees, making the analogy of linking them to rabid dogs.
You know, if there's a rabid dog running around in your neighborhood, you're probably going to put your children out of the way. Doesn't mean that you hate all dogs by any stretch of the imagination, but you're thinking, how do I protect my children? At the same time, I love dogs, and I'm going to call the Humane Society, and hopefully they can come take this dog away and create a safe environment once again.
Okay, well, as you say, it's hard to take these comments seriously. However, these are two of the leading candidates on the Republican side. And so what has been the reaction by Muslim Americans to the GOP in general, given their leading candidates are making these remarks?
Well, absolutely. But what we have to keep in mind is that the Muslim voter, on average, is very well educated. And these comments are clearly not pandering to the very well educated. So the problem is that they may lose the Muslim vote, but it's clear they're not worried about that. What the Muslim American community is more worried about is how these comments can be used, as you were saying, in linking it to Islamic Islam abroad to how American policies are anti-Muslim. So these comments in the U.S. context, the American Muslim voter is very intelligent and will continue to sort of weigh their options in terms of all the issues that concern their daily lives. What's more problematic for American Muslims is how these are going to be used to further global terrorism that then in turn makes American Muslims the, you know, recipients of these comments.
Mm-hmm. And so a backlash in this country by other people, by non-Muslims against Muslim Americans is what you're
saying? Absolutely.
And so talk a little bit more about that. Are we seeing that backlash?
Yeah, so Islamophobia has been on the rise, you know, since 2001 to now. If you look at any of the research statistics, it's just increasingly the case where the American public is more anti-Muslim than they were ever before. There were surveys done in the mid-2000s, you know, showing that Muslims are second only to atheists in terms of who the American public thought was most unlike an average American. Ahead of homosexuals, ahead of immigrants. So they're clearly have been seen as people who can't be American. What's interesting about this with the, you know, the vote, to vote you have to be a citizen. And American Muslims are overwhelmingly citizens, whether by birth or naturalization. So the fact is that this is a group that has been misunderstood, and then the things that are happening abroad are then turned around and used against them here. And just in general, it's ineffective for everyone.
You know, looking back in history, there have been periods where many immigrant groups and ethnic groups and religious minorities have been seen as the other and have been persecuted to one extent or another. You have the Irish coming over here, the Italians, Japanese Americans in internment camps, Jews, all sorts of minority groups have been vilified in our history. So is this just another sad example of that happening, or is it something else?
Well, I'm so glad you bring that up, because rarely do we put the Muslim experience today in a historical context. And the most important thing that this is research I've been doing at Duke is that if you look at those other groups that you just mentioned, typically they've been vilified based on a specific historic moment that posed a national threat to either American security, American religious identity, but those moments passed. World War II ended. JFK became president, and he was a Catholic. And so to a lesser or greater extent, each of these groups was able to assimilate to some degree into American culture. The problem that we're facing today is that there is no isolated event that identifies Muslims as a security threat that's going to end. 9/11 happened. Here we are, you know, in 2015, and the Paris attacks happened. So this is sort of a dynamic process whereby if we could say, okay, in 2 years, ISIS will be wiped out, Muslim Americans can go back to being who they were before 9/11, that would be one thing. I can say with, you know, fairly good certainty that that's not going to happen. And so that makes it very problematic in terms of how do we deal with this group. How do we not isolate good Muslim Americans while these other things are going on abroad?
Let me play a clip of tape from Hillary Clinton. Yesterday, she seems to be courting the Muslim American vote. Here she is.
Let's be clear, though. Islam is not our adversary. Muslims are peaceful and tolerant people and have nothing whatsoever to do with terrorism.
All right. Now, who is she speaking to there, do you think?
She's saying what, you know, everyone knows, but no one's listening to. So that's been said over and over and over and over again. But that's not what people want to hear right now. What people want to hear is that we're going to be safe. We can take our kids to soccer games. We can go to concerts. And her saying that is just saying, okay, I'm smart enough to know that Islam is not all bad. But that's not what people are listening to right now. People want to hear the stuff that Trump and Carson are saying, and that's what's problematic. This is what people are most fearful of in American society today, that we can, any city in the United States can be the next Paris or the next 9/11 incident.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. That's Janan Reed, a professor of sociology and global health at Duke and an assistant director of the Islamic Studies Center there. All right, we want to hear from you. We'd love to hear from you. How is all this campaign rhetoric affecting you? Is it swaying your vote at all? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can find us on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. Coming up on the program, another voting group some politicians have angered, Latinos. We'll find out how that played out last night at the Latin Grammys. That's next on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW radio.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The power of the Hispanic vote has become clear after the last couple of presidential elections. And while that message seems to have been lost on some of the presidential candidates, it has not been lost on Latinos. Last night at the Latin Grammys is a great example. Mexican rockers Maná were joined by Norteño legend Los Tigres del Norte to sing the immigrant anthem Somos Más Americanos, We Are More American. Then, after the song, they unfurled a banner that said in Spanish, Latinos United, don't vote for racists. Carolina Miranda covered what happened for the LA Times, where she writes the culture high and low column. Hi, Carolina.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, first of all, who are these bands?
Well, these are two of the most iconic Mexican bands around, and they are from either side of the border. You have Los Tigres del Norte, which is this legendary Norteño Mexican regional music band that lives in San Jose. And you have Maná, which are this group of pop rockers that live in Mexico. And both have been, you know, very sort of vocal about the need for immigration reform and sort of other political issues affecting Latinos in the United States for a long time. And so as part of their performance, which is an old Los Tigres song from 2001, they decided to also take action on the issue of voter registration.
So this song, tell us about this song. They sang it together?
Yes, the song is a Los Tigres song, and the lyrics, it's this very pro-immigrant anthem. The title literally means we are more American. And the song talks about how, you know, Latin American immigrants, Latinos, are just as American as Americans, if not more so. And, you know, using these sort of clever words of play about, like, you know, we didn't cross the border crossed us. So it's this very rousing song. And when they started playing it on the telecast last night, I was like, oh, this is an interesting political statement to make at a time in which, you know, the GOP candidates are having all of these debates about deportations and illegal immigration and so on and so forth, you know, not realizing that at the end of it, they would then unfurl a banner to kind of launch this movement of registration.
So what was the reaction when they unfurled the banner?
Well, I think, you know, when Los Tigres came on, already the audience got kind of worked up because they're a seminal band. But when they unfurled the banner, they went bananas. And there was a lot of applause. People were on their feet. And, you know, Univision, to their credit, didn't cut away from the banner. They showed it. And so it was this really interesting moment, sort of political moment happening on this very sort of pop awards show, and it social media just went crazy. It was like images of the unfurling of the banner were immediately on Twitter, on Facebook. People were talking about it. It became the moment of the 2015 Latin Grammys.
Well, yeah, and that's interesting that Univision didn't cut away, because Univision has been in the center of this debate with their star anchor Jorge Ramos, you know, getting into it with Donald Trump, and Donald Trump attacking Univision.
Yes, yes. No, they have been. I mean, Univision has taken an advocacy role when it comes to the questions of who their viewership is, which is primarily Latino immigrants. I mean, I think this was a decision the network made early on that, you know, they don't just cover the news. They also represent a very important underrepresented minority in the United States, and one that is often, as we see, vilified in the press.
Mm-hmm. So how much of an effect do you think what happened last night will have on the Latino vote? I know it's not a monolithic vote, but on spurring Latinos, maybe young Latinos, to go out and vote in this election?
Well, they've unfurled the banner in combination with launching a website called Somos Mas 2016, where people can sign up to register to vote. And if you're already registered, you can sign up on the website and it'll send you text messages to remind you to vote. And so the idea is that this is just the first step in an activist campaign with a group called Voto Latino, which is a voter registration group, to get more Latinos registered to vote.
And talk a little bit, if you would, about the politicization, I guess, of this award show. Manah has long made political statements in their songs and in their performances. So is this unusual?
This is not unusual. And actually, it's the second year in a row in which immigration comes up at the Latin Grammys, because last year, the telecast was delayed by 20 minutes so that Obama could give an important policy speech about immigration. And it was one of those things that, you know, I can't imagine any regular Grammy telecast being interrupted for a policy speech by the president, much less one about immigration. But I think it shows you how important, how crucial this issue is to the Latino community. Univision would decide to delay the telecast in order to let the president speak.
Okay, so as long as we're talking about the Latin Grammys, tell us about the highlights, the big winners and losers.
Well, the big winner was a Mexican indie singer named Natalia Lafourcade, who has performed on KCRW, I understand. And mm-hmm. she was someone who came a little bit out of nowhere with her album. She won a total of 5 awards. She was the biggest winner of the night. An album called Hasta la Raíz, very sort of like indie pop song influenced by jazz and a lot of other sort of Latin American song. Yo te llevo de adentro. A very low-key album that was very popular in Mexico, but had received a little bit more of a muted response abroad. And so the fact that she kind of swept the Grammys was a big deal. I think the other thing that we saw was just a couple of general trends, not so much in the awards, but on stage. You know, Latin urban music had a huge presence in this show. Reggaeton opened the show, and it helped close the show, and there were countless reggaeton acts in between. And along with that, there was a lot of Colombian performers. Like, this seemed to be Colombia's Latin Grammys. You had Bomba Estéreo, which is this electronica group, playing Will Smith. You had Chucky B-Town, which is another Colombian hip-hop group, singing alongside some Cuban dancers. And so there was this real presence of Colombian music at the awards as well, which gave it a different flavor from years past.
All right. Well, thanks, Carolina.
Thank you.
That's Carolina Miranda. We have a link to her story about the Latin Grammys on our Facebook page. She writes the culture high and low column for the Los Angeles Times. Okay, that's Chucky B-Town singing Salsa and Choque. Are you a Latina voter? How do messages from bands like Manah or Los Tigres del Norte affect the way you look at politics? Give us a call at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can tweet us at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. Coming up on the program, it's movie time this week. The Hunger Games ends. Todd Haynes brings us a lesbian love story, and our critics tell us about their favorite holiday movies.
It is mind-scrambling. I suppose you could call it a bad film, but it is intensely strange, and you cannot stop looking at it.
Dave White and Alonzo Duralde are here with your reviews after a news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel, stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage on our mobile app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Today, we get to find out if Katniss finally sates her hunger. If you care not for the Hunger Games, there's also a period piece with Cate Blanchett. And if all else fails, Christmas movies. Time for Friday Film. We're joined by movie critic Dave White with linoleum-knife.com. Hi, Dave.
Howdy.
And Alonzo Duralde, chief film critic for The Wrap. Hi there.
Hello.
All right. First up, The Hunger Games Mockingjay Part 2, the final movie in the saga that never seems to end, but finally it is ending. Jennifer Lawrence plays Katniss Everdeen.
You saw Peter, didn't you? Did you tell him hi for me? We're old friends, you know. We had adjoining cells in the Capitol. We're very familiar with each other's screams.
I'm going to kill Snow. Nothing good is safe while he's alive. And I can't make another speech about it.
No, the speeches are over. Alonzo, say it's not true.
I'm a fan of this franchise. I have to say, having suffered through some really terrible YA franchises, some of which are still happening, this one I think is head and shoulders above so many of them. I think you care about the characters, the action is exciting, and I think as far as having kind of a political point of view, this is a valuable, I think a lot of young people are going to kind of get, you know, kind of their first idea of how does propaganda work and how does, you know, the military industrial complex work and that kind of thing from these movies. I think these films really have a very subtle undercurrent of asking that you question authority.
So this is their gateway drug to Huxley, to Orwell.
Absolutely. Yeah,
And this has really made Jennifer Lawrence a star. Nobody really knew who she was. She was in an indie movie before this, which got great critical acclaim.
Yeah, and she got an Oscar nomination.
Yeah,
too,
but this is really what made her. I mean, she is Katniss, right?
Yeah, she really is. And her performance through all four of these films has been, you know, if anything else isn't happening, she's happening in the movie. She is a magnetic presence.
And when she's not making these massively popular and critically acclaimed action movies, she's off doing these David O. Russell films that snag her awards and prestige. So she's really riding that line of being an income generator for the studios, but also being respected for the work. So it'll be interesting now that this is behind her. How does she maintain that balance in the future?
And these four films. Okay, I'll just be honest. I'm as glad that they're done as everyone else. But not since the Harry Potter movies has a young adult series film adaptation been handled with this much care. Mm-hmm. And it's ambitious when so many others just are not. They're content to ape all of the cliches and conventions of the young adult, you know,
post-genre.
Yeah.
The Hunger Games films are serious rather than a kind of parody of seriousness, which is, I think, what kills the divergent insurgent. I never can remember their name.
Detergent.
I've stopped watching them.
Insignificant.
And they're full of action, and they're fun to watch, and they're action movies that are not afraid of downtime. You need those moments in a film like this to move things along.
And after the Twilight movies, it's nice to see a heroine who's in a love triangle where the love triangle is the least interesting thing about her, or at least the thing that she's the least interested in. She's got bigger fish to fry. If anybody is sort of obsessed with how that's going to turn out, it's the guys.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas she's like, yeah, whatever. I got a world to save.
It passes the Bechdel test. Flying colors.
And then,
oh, yes. Can I also shout out to Jenna Malone, the best supporting character in this whole franchise? The amount of eye rolling and side eye deadpan line readings out of her. She steals every little second that she's in, and I just think she's terrific.
Well, so we haven't even talked about the plot. Do we need to? She comes in and
she won the Hunger Games, then she leaves the rebellion.
Now the rebellion comes to a climax, and if you haven't read the book, you'll be surprised.
No, you won't.
No, probably
you won't, because there's no other outcome.
Okay. Next up, a period love story starring Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara. It's called Carol.
Maybe you'd like to come visit me sometime. You're welcome to. At least there's some pretty country around where I live. Would you like to come visit me this Sunday?
Yes.
What a strange girl you are.
Why?
Flung out of space.
Okay, you can feel the tension. This is based on a Patricia Highsmith novel, Dave.
That's how a lady puts it on a lady.
Uh-huh.
That is how you seduce. And it's this is such an incredible film. It's based on Patricia Highsmith's novel, The Price of Salt, that was published in the 50s under a pseudonym because it was a lesbian romance. And you couldn't be Patricia Highsmith and have your name on that back then. So Todd Haynes has taken it and adapted it in that perfect Todd Haynes way. He has been concerned with this kind of subject matter since his notorious beginning with Superstar, the Karen Carpenter short film that he made with the Barbie dolls.
Which you can't see.
You can see it on YouTube.
You can.
But,
yeah.
Right.
But this film about two women in love in the 1950s and the problems that come along with that are absolutely in keeping with the kinds of movies he's made about women in the past.
Starting, also setting in the 1950s.
Yes, yeah. Starting with Superstar and through Safe and Far From Heaven and Mildred Pierce, the miniseries for HBO. He has this concern for women who are bound by circumstances of their environment or of their era and how they sort of bump up against that stuff.
I was reading an interview with Haynes, and this is apparently the first project that came to him that he didn't initiate. The Phyllis Nagy had already written this screenplay that was already a producer who'd been trying to get this book adapted for years. But it feels so completely at home in his, you know, body of work that you would think that it was just another film that he was sort of spearheading from the get-go. He fits into it so comfortably. And obviously he brings in a lot of people that he's worked with before. Cate Blanchett, who so memorably played one of the Bob Dylans in I'm Not There. Cinematographer Ed Lockman, who also shot Far From Heaven and Mildred Pierce in I'm Not There. And yeah, it does absolutely fit in with his concerns, both about women's lives, but also about queer subtext, about how do gays and lesbians communicate with each other, find each other, exist in a world that denies them their very being. And so much of this film is coded in that way of the 1950s and how people had to have these conversations in public and even in private. So you, as the audience, are asked to do that level of interpretation and reading. So scenes where seemingly nothing is happening or the conversation is very banal,
there's tons going on under
the surface.
Wow, fascinating. Well, when I think of Patricia Highsmith, I think of Cold-Blooded Suspense.
Yes. Sure, Mr. Ripley.
Yeah, the Mr. Ripley, Strangers on a Train. Is that this movie or is this something else?
Not at all.
This is something entirely else. This is a very restrained film. And that is, of course, like Alonzo just said, in keeping with the idea of if you were a homosexual 60 years ago, your life was bound and you had to watch your every move. And so the film is that way too. And what's wonderful, he just mentioned Ed Lachman, the cinematographer, what's wonderful about the visual storytelling here is that much like in Mildred Pierce, if you go back and watch that, he shoots a significant amount of the shots are the female characters behind glass, either looking out or looking in. They're framed by some dirty winter smudged window. And it evokes this idea of separation, of being, you know, imprisoned at times. And it's stunning. It is an incredible film.
It's one of the best movies of the year, no question.
Okay. Let us move on to something entirely different. The Night Before, starring Joseph Gordon-Levitt, Seth Rogen, and Anthony Mackie.
All right, so I called the number on these tickets. They don't give out the address till like 10. So that gives us like several hours to hit as many Christmas traditions as possible.
Nice.
And it's going to be the best night of our lives.
So psyched, man. Awesome.
Maybe it'll be like the new Christmas tradition.
don't know if we're really replacing this with another tradition.
That's a joke. That's a joke. Okay. Give him some credit. Obviously, that was a joke.
All right, Alonzo, brotastic?
Very much, yes. Like Carol, set at Christmas, but the resemblance ends there. yeah, this is very much a Judd Apatow-esque comedy that Judd Apatow didn't make. But yeah, Seth Rogen, Joseph Gordon-Levitt, and Anthony Mackie are three friends who have spent every Christmas Eve together for the last 15 years, ever since the death of Joseph Gordon-Levitt's parents. But now Rogen's character is about to have a baby with his wife, and Mackie's character is a famous athlete and they've got other fish to fry, so they're ready to kind of make this the last one and also kind of give JGL a kick in the pants to get his life together as well. And it is a raunchy, R-rated Christmas comedy, and we don't have enough of those, so I'm very much in favor of that. And while this isn't a great movie, I laughed consistently and enough so that by the end of it, I felt like I had been fully entertained by this thing.
I'm Team Rogen. I really am, and I have been since Freaks and Geeks, since all the way back when he was, 17
yeah.
or whatever. I enjoy the recurring themes here with these comedies as well. They are always pushing something about sex or drugs or friendship or religion or what it means to grow up, with the interview, even international politics. I love that he and James Franco have positioned themselves as this sort of homoerotic Martin and Lewis.
and I like that you said that in stereo.
And in this film in particular, I'm fond of the supporting cast, people like Ilana Glazer from Broad City, Nathan Fielder.
The women are given stuff to do
Mindy
in this movie,
Kaling,
by the way,
Lizzie
which
Kaplan.
Is not always the case in
it's
this
not
kind
just
of
a hangover
yeah.
film.
Yeah.
kind of thing.
But as much as I laughed from start to finish, and I did because I'm 12, I haven't seen anything in this movie that I haven't seen before
yeah.
from them. And
but maybe that's what we all want.
It is.
Sure.
And at
Christmas
the same
movies
time,
are about giving you what you
yeah.
expect. By
there was this little nagging voice in the back of my head as I watched it. And as I laughed, I thought, don't start spinning your wheels. Keep pushing. Don't get older and get old, please, because then you're stuck. And then you're making movies that aren't funny anymore.
I mean,
I like an ambitious Christmas movie,
yeah,
too.
There's no excuses.
All right. So really quickly, favorite Christmas movie, Dave?
There are two that I really love. I love the 1959 Mexican children's film, Santa Claus, or if you are speaking it in Spanish, you're saying Santa Claus. It is a bizarre, bizarre, surreal
baby's first Buñuel.
Yeah, movie about Santa fighting the devil with the help of Merlin the Magician. They did it on Mystery Science Theater a long time ago. That's what got me aware of it. It is mind-scrambling. It is, I suppose you could call it a bad film, but it is intensely strange, and you cannot stop looking at it. The other one I love is Christmas Evil, which is a horror film. And it turns out this is John Waters' favorite Christmas movie as well. About a horror film about a man who believes himself to be Santa Claus, and he's going around killing people who do not exhibit the spirit of Christmas. And this is a spoiler, but it's such a cool spoiler that I'm going to do it anyway. At the end, it turns out he really is Santa Claus. It's amazing.
Well, that's open to interpretation. The ending, that is, not the amazing part.
He flies off in his grimy white van into the sky.
Okay,
but
so,
like
so,
a sleigh.
But does he really, or does he just think he does?
Oh, he does.
Oh, trippy. So no Jimmy Stewart for you. All right, Alonzo?
Yeah, this is a tough one for me, since I have written an entire book on the subject.
Yes, he did.
Have yourself a movie, Little Christmas, now available wherever fine books are sold.
Been available for a while.
And still is. You know, I have a very soft spot for the 1970 musical Scrooge with Albert Finney. I'm a big fan of Leslie Bricus, who did the music and wrote the screenplay. And it's one of the few, I think it's maybe the only Christmas Carol movie where young Scrooge and old Scrooge are played by the same actor. Which I think makes a big difference. And I like the songs a lot. And, you know, the ghosts are played by, you know, Alec Guinness and Dame Edith Evans and Kenneth Moore. And it's just
a
blast.
Is there a 70s vibe to it?
It's a very 60s
yeah.
vibe.
Oh.
It's a very post-Oliver musical. So yeah. lots of the streets of London filling with choreographed Cockneys kind of thing. But there is like a 20-minute finale that involves a reprise of every song from the movie, every character in the movie dancing their little hearts out. And if you do not like weep during this, you are dead inside.
Wow. Okay. So I see like Happy Christmas over here with Alonzo.
Horror Christmas.
Dark lump of coal for a heart over here with Dave.
But Santa Claus is great.
I love It's a Wonderful Life, too, you know, and White Christmas. I watch those every year. But everybody watches those every year. So you already know. You don't need another person telling you, oh, you should really see It's a Wonderful Life. Well, you already have. So, you know, horror. That's what we don't get enough of at Christmas.
And I will say, I'm about the only person right now who is defending Love the Coopers. I think it's a way better movie than most critics gave it credit for being.
Really?
Yeah, I know. I'm part of the 17% on Rotten Tomatoes, so I understand that I'm whistling in the dark here. But
you're whistling in the dark in our own home.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to go home after this, Alonzo. All right, you guys. Merry Christmas. God, I can't believe I'm saying that. Stop it.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving, Madeline Brand.
Thank you. Alonzo Duralde, Chief Film Critic for The Wrap. Dave White, Film Critic with Linoleum-Knife.com. Together, they host the Linoleum Knife Podcast. So check it out, download it, listen to it, laugh, cry, whatever else.
All the things.
Thanks, you guys.
Thanks.
Happy Friday to you, Warren Olney.
Well, happy Friday to you as well.
Thank
and to
you.
All of our listeners, too. We're going to be talking today about the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court once again is taking up the question of abortion, not directly, but in terms of regulations that are being established in several states. Texas is the one that has got the case going to the U.S. Supreme Court that make it more difficult for women to get abortions. At least that's what the pro-abortion people are claiming. Those who are pro-life claim that the regulations are really designed to protect the health of the women and that they should have the very best kind of medical facilities. Well, the other side is saying, yeah, that's fine if they aren't 550 miles one way to make a drive, especially for a poor women. So it's a very interesting case. It has to do with the undue burdens that the Supreme Court says are not permissible with regard to abortion rights.
And so what is the specific constitutional argument that
the constitutional argument is that a woman has a constitutional right to choose and that regulations can be imposed, but not, this is according to a prior case, not if they impose an undue burden on the exercise of that right. So the argument comes down to how difficult is it for women in Texas and other places to get abortions if, for example, there are abortion clinics closing down because they can't meet the new standards. Therefore, women have to drive long distances. There's also a very interesting question about alternatives that are being provided by the people who are right-to-life proponents, which appear to be abortion counseling clinics, but in fact are clinics run and financed by abortion opponents who then get people in and advise them that maybe they should do something else.
All right. Looking forward to that discussion coming up at 1 o'clock, To the Point with Warren Olney.
It's a good one.
It is. Sounds like a great one. Thank you. And coming up on this program, a scandal that is dividing an Olympic sport. It does not involve Russians or doping or bribery. It does involve brooms. We'll have that story next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Santa Monica. KCRW is listener-supported. Help us continue to create and distribute our unique content. Go to kcrw.com/join to donate. And thanks.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we would be remiss if we let today's program end without reporting on a big controversy taking place in the world of curling, as in the sport. Yes, curlers everywhere are up in arms over their brooms. Most of the world's curlers live north of the border in Canada, where people really take this sport seriously. You can watch it on TV. There's color commentary. So to explain what's going on with curlers and their brooms, we've reached out to Matt English. He's a writer and former curler in Toronto. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
All right. So for someone who doesn't know anything about this sport, curling, tell us about it. It involves people on ice in shoes with brooms, right?
Basically, yeah. So I guess the best way to explain it is it's kind of like shuffleboard on ice. That might not be giving it enough credit. But essentially what you're doing is you're releasing a rock down a sheet of ice, and you have two sweepers who use brooms that they have sort of a fabric surface on the bottom, kind of more like a Swiffer, and they sweep in front of the rock to make it move further or move less. And the rocks themselves, because of the sort of physics of the game, actually curl, which is why it's called curling. So if you release it and turn the handle clockwise, then instead of going in a straight line, the rock will move about 4 feet to the right. So there's controversy now going on because there's new brooms that can control the rocks to an extent that we've never seen before.
Wow. Okay, so talk about that. Is it the material in the brooms themselves?
It's a bit complicated, and there's a lot of science involved that is, you know, beyond me. But essentially what we're talking about is a hard plastic insert that's being put into the actual broom fabric and sort of a rough grain to the fabric material. I haven't touched one yet, but I've heard from people who have played with them, and it's apparently kind of a sandpaper quality to it.
Mm-hmm.
So what this enables is you can put more pressure onto the ice and essentially make the rock move further than before. You can sweep it in a certain way so that it goes left or right. Basically, from people who've seen these brooms in action, it sounds like you can basically control the rock like it was a video game. You can just make it dart in and out, make it go the wrong direction, make it go 4 feet farther than it should have normally. So it's definitely a huge competitive advantage to be using these new hardline brooms.
Okay, so what is the big controversy? I hear it's being called Broomapalooza.
Broomapalooza, Broomgate, whatever you want to call it. So these new brooms were by a new upstart curling manufacturing company called Hardline.
Uh-huh.
And they were actually developed as kind of a secret project by the Canadian Olympic organization to give Canadian curlers an advantage at the 2010 Olympics. They've been flying under the radar for a few years now, but this is the year that it's all sort of come to a head, that teams have started using them in competition. And the more sort of old school traditional teams have said, well, wait a minute, this is a huge unfair advantage. I guess the best example would be like if in baseball one team was allowed to use aluminum bats and no one else was.
Yeah.
That's the sort of advantage we're talking about.
So why don't all of them just use these new ones, new brooms?
Well, yeah, good question. And there are a lot of people saying, you know, get with the times, that this is a new technology, it helps the game. A lot of commentators and a few teams in Canada are saying, you know, embrace the new technology, this is the way the sport's going. But there's also, curling is a very traditional, old-school sport. You know, it's still sort of a small-town game where people like to, you know, drink beer and hang out. So it's not really seen as a sport like, you know, football or baseball or hockey or something where everyone's trying to get the latest edge. It's more sort of a community, old-school sport, I guess.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are saying that using these this new fancy technology is taking some of the the finesse out of the game. That before, if you were a highly skilled player, you'd be able to put the rock right exactly where you want it. But now, if you've got these new brooms, you don't need to be perfect. You could throw the rock a few feet light and then just rely on the brooms to sort of make up for your mistake.
So the old school guys are saying this is kind of cheating. Like, you're relying too much on this new technology, this new fancy broom, and you're not really using your own skill and finesse.
Absolutely, yeah. And a lot of the teams, there's been meetings, there's been summits, there was a lot of the top teams in the world sort of signed a letter saying we will not use these new brooms, we will not compete against people who use the new brooms. But then there's some teams saying, look, you know, if this broom is going to give us an edge, we're going to use it. There's been like summits on broom technology, there's been debates on how much of, a grain in the broom is too much, so... It's been a whole big controversy up here in Canada.
Wow. So that is some pretty exciting stuff. Will there be some august body who will decide on this, sort of an IOC of brooms?
Yeah, there's the World Curling Federation, and there's already been some movements to ban the new brooms, but it's hard to ban a specific broom because then they'll just come out with a new broom with the same technology. So we're probably going to be going through a lot of meetings about all the top players and all the top manufacturers of brooms. The problem is the manufacturers want to put the best product out there if it helps the players the most. And the players, you know, obviously want a fair playing field, so they're not playing against guys who have better technology than them. And there's also an added wrinkle that a lot of these players are sponsored by the manufacturers themselves,
mm-hmm.
because there's not too many sponsors in the curling world. So the sort of big three or four curling broom manufacturers are often the biggest sponsors of these teams.
Aha, uh-huh. The plot thickens. Also, I'm wondering what the international ramifications are, because you said that this was developed in secret by the Canadians. What about other countries? Are they crying foul over these brooms?
Yeah, so, I mean, there's obviously going to have to be some sort of standardization that comes up probably by the IOC before the next Olympics in 2018. Until then, it's going to be up to local governing bodies. They're going to have to release some sort of standards on what is and isn't an acceptable level of broom, I guess. And I guess then it's going to have to go from there until all the players and all the manufacturers and all the governing bodies can agree on a standard.
Okay, so this is known, as you said, as a friendly sport. And I guess it is a sport, you know, even though people wear suits on the ice and use brooms. But it is a full-fledged sport. It's in the Olympics. But it's something that is considered more of a friendly, you know, neighborhood activity. So is this really ruining people's relationships with each other?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's been teams who've refused to play against other teams because they're using the new brooms. There's been a lot of sort of iciness with a lot of the top players. And again, a lot of it is sort of a generational thing. A lot of the new young teams are trying to use the best technology, and a lot of the sort of old school teams who grew up with the game back in the 80s and 90s, when it was more just, you know, guys with big guts drinking a beer on the ice, smoking a cigarette. They want to sort of maintain the traditional aspect of the game.
So it's pitting neighbor against neighbor.
Exactly.
Wow. Matt, thanks for clearing this up for us.
My pleasure.
Matt English is a writer and curling fan. He's based in Toronto. Jolie Myers, who knew there was so much drama in curling?
I love that what passes for a big, nefarious, like, secret plot in Canada involves curling brooms. Like, Canada,
I know.
You're the best.
You're no Russia.
You guys just keep doing you. Canada's the best. Okay, so near the beginning of the show, we talked about how the Muslim vote is reacting to all of these debates playing out in Congress right now, mm-hmm. Syrian refugees, Donald Trump's comment about keeping a registry of Muslims, Muslim Americans and Muslims alike. Michael called in. He says that the idea of keeping a registry of Muslims seems like bad satire to him and his friends here in Los Angeles. But through the magic of Facebook, Michael sees what his acquaintances in Quayton, his friends and relatives around the country are saying, and it is scary stuff. Hasina says on Facebook that she came to the country from Afghanistan in the 1980s, but the America she knew then is gone. This is crazy. This is absurd. Russell Dilley says that he just doesn't understand this whole fear of Muslims. If you look at who's perpetrating terrorist attacks, mass shootings, in America over the past 10 years, it's people who identify as Christians. But Ali Khan says that everyone just needs to calm down about this. The rule of law and the Constitution, they still exist. Ali says that he has at least a little bit of faith in the American way. Left Americans will not let this happen, is what Ali says on Facebook.
Okay, we can hope so. And if you want to weigh in on this, please, we welcome you. Facebook, KCRW Press Play. Jolie Myers, have a great weekend. Thank you very much.
You too.
Warren Olney is next here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great weekend, everyone. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.